You're listening to
Kaput
Radio.
Completely Kaput.
Authorised by New South Wales Government, Sydney.
You cannot buy Kaput Radio.
Why is it we have so many millionaires and everything in the United States, and we still have so many impoverished people who try to get up into the world? Why is it we have this lack of money where people who can't support themselves decently and get a decent job, where all these big men are up on top making oodles and oodles of money? They don't need it. They can only eat that much.
First place, Nirvana is not for this world. There is no paradise.
Where are we going, Mummy?
We're going to the field to set the car on fire before the bank repossesses it.
But, Mummy, it's a wonderful old car.
Oh, I know, darling. I've been paying for it since before you were born.
What a curious sound it's making.
I can't afford the good gas, darling.
What's it saying?
It's saying... Shitty, 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 shitty.
Bank, bank.
Shitty, bank, bank. Shitty, shitty, bank, bank. Shitty, bank, bank. Shitty, shitty, bank, bank. Shitty, bank, bank. Shitty, shitty, bank, bank. Oh, you. Shitty, shitty, bank, bank. Shitty, shitty, bank, bank. We hate you. And our pretty shitty bank, bank. Shitty, shitty, bank, bank. Hates us too. Hello. Everywhere our rates go on shitty, shitty, we depend. Bank, bank, shitty, shitty, bank, bank. Our fine foreclosure friend. Bank, bank, shitty, shitty, bank, bank. Our fine foreclosure friend. You cheat and you take our dough, leaving us on skid row. You're bailed out and we're left out to dry. They say that money talks, but we're living in a box. I know you're hungry, honey, please don't cry. Oh, shitty you, shitty, pretty, shitty, bank, bank. Shitty, shitty, bank, bank, we hate you. And shitty our shitty, pretty, shitty, bank, bank. Shitty, shitty, bank, bank, hates us too. High, shitty, low, shitty, everywhere we go on. Shitty, shitty, we depend. Bank, bank, shitty, shitty, bank, bank. Our fine foreclosure friend. Bank, bank, shitty, shitty, bank, bank. Our fine foreclosure friend.
When you see around the globe the maldistribution of wealth, the desperate plight of millions of people in underdeveloped countries, when you see so few haves and so many have-nots, When you see the greed and the concentration of power within, did you ever have a moment of doubt about capitalism and whether greed's a good idea to run on?
You think China doesn't run on greed? What is greed?
Once upon a time, a group of people with high-minded goals, intelligent thoughts and ideas aspired to create a true civil society, a real civilization.
Written records go back about 4,000 years, and from 2000 BC to the time of Jesus, it was normal for all of the countries in the world to periodically cancel the debts when they became too large to pay. So you have Sumer, Babylonia, Egypt, other regions, all proclaiming these debt cancellations, and the effect was to make a clean slate so that society would begin all over again.
The great and not-so-great thinkers of the time gathered and debated, formed and reformed political theory and various schools of philosophy, and gave rise to the concept of a republic and an economy.
This was easy to do in a society where most debts were owed to the state. It became much harder to do when enterprise and credit passed out of the hands of the state into private hands and into the hands of an oligarchy.
Philosophy was the unifying focus central to all other issues, and debating forums were the order of the day. Teachers from near and far came and went. Healers from many disciplines of the healing arts gathered. People with expertise in the natural science met and exchanged their ideas. An egalitarian society emerged. A baker, a carpenter, a teacher, and an engineer were held in similar esteem, were respected, and received rewards reflecting their value to civilized society. An emergent true and rational civilization was forming, and a competing system, as in empire building by the force of arms, had not and has not yet run its evolutionary course. However, for hundreds of years, the formation of a thinking civil society emerged to prosper on and off in different lands. Much labor and many domestic animals were required for the daily chores, for farming and transport. This type of labor-intensive civilization lasted for a few thousand years. The small world population began to prosper very slowly, but human curiosity and the restless mind was then and continues to be never satisfied.
Rome was the first country of the world not to cancel the debts. It went to war in Sparta, in Greece, to overthrow the governments and the kings that wanted to cancel the debts.
Today, the mind is not restless anymore, just dissatisfied. It is not even curious because the world forums iterate and reiterate that all is known there on the information superhighway. Nothing to be curious about. What's left is an endless procession of similar grievances and dissatisfactions. And if just repeated often and to enough people, something must happen. But it can't happen. The necessity to be curious, to question, has been removed by innovations and inventions far beyond the initial level.
How do you do? How do you do? This is the truce.
Burglars, rapists, frauders, muggers. Is it because most of our age is less than 11? Burglars, rapists, fraudsters and muggers. Is it because most of our age is less than 11? What are they all doing, these guys? Yeah, probably. It's probably not good to have people not be able to read. Yeah, I went to a prison once, visiting, and I heard that, like, most of the women couldn't read. Yeah, it was a women's prison. It's getting more suspicious by the second, isn't it, story? But in a way, it's like society is this factory that produces these people that can't read, and then those people go to prison. It would make a difference. Andy McNab, who is proposing this, is right. That people should have access to literacy and good education. We've a story where we've got to start caring about her. Well, you've brainwashed me. NHS, stop having a go at the NHS, stop trying to privatise everything. Definitely better to have free healthcare than not have free healthcare. When you're in America and you see people coughing up for healthcare, it makes you feel a weird feeling in your stomach to profit from other people's misery and misfortune. I wanted to drink some booze to get rid of the feeling of fear. But it doesn't have to just be booze, it could be anything, even like daft sunbathing, like it said in the mail, or chocolate or anything. She don't want to deal with the feelings, she wants some distraction, and you know that the body will provide temporary endorphin distraction if you consume certain products or engage in certain activities, sex or consuming or whatever. So he's right here. Every addiction starts with pain and ends with pain. Of course it will, because the pain's not gone anywhere, has it? You've just sort of delayed it, you've put a barrier between you and the pain. Whatever the substance you're addicted to, alcohol, food, legal or illegal drugs, or a person, you're using something or somebody to cover up your pain. Accept where we are, change where we are, or leave where we are. We can all do that. Say it's society and the way that it's organised. We can either accept it, I don't accept it. Change it, I'm well up for changing it. Leave it, can't leave it because we all live it. So change it, it's the only option we've got.
Is a tool that is abused to fool you and to leave you scared and confused. Truths is like the news. If the news was true, I want some truths. Let's have some truths.
Society explored the inner worlds first, but later, vehicles, machines, and ships were invented to explore the material space-time world. In a short time of one or two generations, people explored the whole planet and also developed machines to do the hard work instead of human or animal power being used. In turn, people felt they should receive extra benefits from this development. They devised a way to pay tokens of an assumed value to each other for goods and services provided. This token was called money, although the term money is not accurately describing the medium of exchange they agreed on. The method by which this medium of exchange was created tells another story. For now, it suffices to say that many different competing methods were in use until one day in 1694 a country called England cast a law into existence giving exclusive right to just one method of creating a medium of exchange and outlawing all other used variants in existence.
When Amschel Meyer Bauer inherited the business, he decided to change his name to Rothschild. Amschel soon learned that loaning money to governments and kings was more profitable than loaning to private individuals. Not only were the loans bigger, but they were secured by the nation's taxes. Mayor Rothschild had five sons. He trained them all in the skills of money creation, then sent them out to the major capitals of Europe to open branch offices of the family banking business. His first son, Amschel Mayer, stayed in Frankfurt to mine the hometown bank. His second son, Solomon, was sent to Vienna. His third son, Nathan, was clearly the most clever. He was sent to London at age 21 in 1798, 100 years after the founding of the Bank of England. His fourth son, Carl, went to Naples, and his fifth son, Jacob, went to Paris. Rothschild soon grew unbelievably wealthy. By the mid-1800s, they dominated all European banking and were certainly the wealthiest family in the world.
The people in England felt that any other method would threaten their situation, although this was a deplorable misconception driven by ignorance and a good dose of fear clouding their thinking.
Money changers, those who loan out and manipulate the quantity of money, were active in medieval England. In fact, they were so active that acting together, they could manipulate the entire English economy.
The experience so far has been shaped by a lot of competitive warfare for their own survival against rivals of their neighbors.
Oliver Cromwell finally overthrew King Charles, purged the parliament, and put the king to death. The money changers were immediately allowed to consolidate their financial power. The result was that for the next 50 years, the money changers plunged Great Britain into a series of costly wars. They took over a square mile of property in the center of London, known as the City of London. This area today is still known as one of the three predominant financial centers of the world.
During the period of inventions of machines, the change from labor-intensive to capital-intensive economy, the fear of losing out and the previous presumed scarcity of resources all reduced their earlier high-minded society to an ever more unintelligent thinking and behavior with lower and lower aspirations and ever increasing fear of loss, driving their behavior without ever questioning the original premise of the used method of a medium of exchange for goods and services provided.
Henry Ford the First, the founder of the dynasty, had the following statement, which is very striking. He said that if Americans understood money and banking, there would be a revolution the next day. I happen to believe he's right. And the fact that we did not have a revolution is, to me, strong evidence that Americans still don't understand money and banking to this day.
While some British and American financial institutions put profits before principles, banking with Hitler.
A quote from the Rothschild Brothers of London writing to associates in New York, 1863. The few who understand the system will either be so interested in its profits or be so dependent upon its favors that there will be no opposition from that class, while on the other hand, the great body of people mentally incapable of comprehending the tremendous advantage that capital derives from the system will bear its burdens without complaint, and perhaps without even suspecting that the system is inimical to their interests.
Now, the big news, obviously, in our country, England, is that there is a thing called a budget where they tell you, to a point, what they're going to do with the money you gave them. The briefcase is a meaningless symbol. And as you know, money is a symbol. It's a representative idea. That isn't actually the money, is it? Like a ticket to India is not a journey to India. It's an emblem. It's a promise. It's an icon. It's an idea of a ticket. And the economy itself is a belief system. We choose to believe, okay, that this system works. This is the system we're going to go along with. You lot are telling us it's the best. Doesn't matter whether you're reading this newspaper and you're a lovable old dope, or this one and you're a fierce, yellow-fanged old Tory, or this one and you're a lovely, cuddly old liberal, or this one and you're a relatively traditional, tiny bit racist type person. Wherever you get your information, you're getting told that the economy is either yeah or it's you know, it's very narrow parameters that we're discussing. But what about just cancel all everyone's debts? Cancel everybody's debts, right? You don't have to pay your mortgage now, you don't have to pay any of your loans back. What? That is unthinkable. Can you imagine the consequences if we were to just start cancelling debt for people, normal people? There are no circumstances under which we would just cancel a load of debt from people because... What do you mean? The banking crisis... You? Oh, yeah, no, we did then. Yeah, we did. We just cancelled all the debt. Yeah, we just gave them the money. We've lost all this money. Load of them ideas that we had that we told you were good. Bundles, mortgages, insurance. Them ideas were terrible. Terrible. They were really good for us, actually, because we made loads of money. But we're going to need that money back, otherwise we're going to capsize the economy, which is an imaginary thing. It doesn't have an actual, literal relationship with any resources or any people. It's a belief system. It's sort of like a poem. It's actually like a pagan god. It's just like a belief. The economy, behold, the economy. The savings revolution. It's not a revolution. A revolution would be if we sliced George's head clean off, popped it in that bag, and then presented it in the same manner. What they're telling you here is that they think you are an idiot. They think we're idiots. Look, wingo with an exclamation mark. One, tax on bingo, horse half. Thanks, mate. Two pence of a pint of bitter. Oh, God, thank you. Is it the bee towels? What? So, like, they're wondering what to put on the back of the new pound coin, because, again, it is a metaphor, it is a symbol, so you can put anything on it. Why don't you put, I don't believe in this silly idea anymore. I'd rather have chocolate coins that I can eat before bedtime. They were delicious. What I will say is these newspapers hate you. They think you're stupid and that you don't deserve anything from life, that you should just shut up.
Not a bank, it's a banker. Not a paper, not a symbol. Not a building, not a bubble. Just some bad seed human beings. Not a bank, it's a banker. Not a paper, not a symbol. Not a building, not a bubble. Just some bad seed human beings. This is the story of a middleman's life. Loved baseball, bowling, and banging his wife. And they had two children, Rick and Jane. And they shared their love, kissed away the pain. And every day the bills come in. Middleman pays the best he can. Now only bones are left of him. Gave the banker all of his skin. 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 Middleman believed in free will. Knows the credit card is not a magic pill. And when they found a house, the bank said, buy it. Unaware of the banker's insatiable diet. And every day the bills come in. Middleman paid the best he can. Now only bones are left of him. Cause he gave the banker all of his skin. Gave the banker all of his skin. How did the banker reward him? Raised his rate to 3 times 10. Now the Holy Bank of Taj Mahal, Bank of the Royal Untouchables, rain an endless rain of selfish goals, and stole the American middleman's soul. Every day the bills come in. The money became his true religion. There's not one law protecting him. Cause he gave the banker all of his skin. 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 Middleman had not a greedy hand. He was an honest Joe like a Campbell's soup man. But he lost his job and mama got thin. When they took his house, turned to a life of sin. So he held up Raheed at the local store. When I win my millions, I'll pay you back more.
But that day God forgot to keep score, and middleman died in a puddle on the floor. And every day the bills come in, money became his true religion. There's not one law protecting him, 'cause he gave the banker all of his skin, gave the banker all of his skin. How did the banker reward him? Raised his rate to 3 times 10. Not a bank, it's a banker. Not a paper, not a symbol. Not a building, not a bubble. Just some bad seed human beings. Not a bank, it's a banker. Not a paper, not a symbol. Not a building, not a bubble. Just some bad seed human beings. Not a bank, it's a banker. Not a paper, not a symbol. Not a building, not a bubble, just some bad seed human beings. Not a bank, it's a banker. Not a paper, not a symbol. Not a building, not a bubble, just some bad seed human beings.
Some corporations get very rich off military contracts. That's why they've hired 843 lobbyists and recently spent $210 million to influence Congress to protect their profits.
There are companies that help break things by making the tools for violence and destruction, such as Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman. There are companies that fix what gets broken, such as Bechtel and Halliburton. There are companies that protect people as they break things and as they fix what's broken, such as Blackwater and Vinylcorp. There are companies that want our government to smash across borders so that they may bring new products and infrastructure, companies that we will see set up shop in that country. There are companies that want our government to smash across other countries' borders so they may suck the resources out from underneath the people there, such as the big oil companies. There are companies that like the U.S. to attack other countries so that they may have something entertaining to tell their audiences in the time between commercials, such as ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, and CNN.
So you don't have any spare machine guns or some old cannons?
I can't afford a spare one.
No,
I just have to make do with the one I've got.
And can you survive with it, or is it not bound to end up in the same alley as all the other conflicts?
Well, the idea is that I don't survive with it. The idea is that somebody else doesn't survive.
All right,
because
yeah.
I shoot them.
Yeah. And that's necessary to safeguard your assets and the values, defending the values.
Well, there can never be enough to go around, so you've got to reduce the opposition. You've got to reduce.
Yeah. But I heard this is sort of that's a yarn they put out, these people who manufacture those things, you know, the arms industries. They put this out as a. It's like the gun lobby. You know? You're not secure without our product, you know, they claim. You know?
They try
to talk everybody into it. You know?
Well, that's why I have one. But the problem is we don't want the opposition to have a better one than we're.
Yeah.
Mine would really be superior to the other bloke.
I noticed this sort of whole this arms exporting thing has now sort of opened up a new avenue with new products in the field, like spying on military secrets. Like Boeing just got hacked, and other companies got hacked apparently by Chinese spies, you know, to find out the secrets of the F-35, for instance, the latest product of Boeing.
They shouldn't have worried we will be getting them to make these eventually.
So they need to know.
So they need to know.
They need to know how those things operate, so they can build them.
Yeah.
And they won't use them against us? Or?
Well, we are their livelihood. You don't shoot your livelihood.
No, you wouldn't want to chop off the hand feeding you. Yeah, that's right. But that's an interesting aspect which a lot of people don't seem to overlook. No? Like, we are actually making profits. When we can't make any profits anywhere else, we can still make profits with arms exports.
Yes, as long as we don't kill everybody.
Yeah, it's got to be a certain level, a certain threshold. Or
yeah, well, as long as it's just enough to create that ferment where we need protection, we need gun. If we really wiped out enough people, there'd be no need for this protection.
Yeah.
So, you've got to keep the thing going.
Just enough to move the elbow and make the hand sign the contract.
The hand that signed the contract was also on the trigger of the gun.
Yeah. So that is a fine line to tread, isn't it? It's not an easy thing.
Yeah, that's very difficult.
Yeah. It's a highly skilled, developed way. Mr. Rumsfeld did this in America in the past, and I noticed others, not named by name, but similar actors, seem to have a high position of responsibility in this whole business.
Well, the responsibility, of course, is to the industry. I think that he's better off than I am, so therefore he's doing a better job than I am. Providing for himself. Mm.
Now, I wonder when these arms industries, where do they, I mean, they need to have paid their wages or their development costs and all this. These costs, where do they come from? Where's the money coming from for paying for the costs of actually making those arms, the cannons and the F-35 or whatever we look at?
The
latest gun or whatever.
For them to actually purchase our product, sometimes we have to make sure they have enough income.
Oh, yeah.
And so we do trading deals.
So what, we give them the money?
We can do it that way as
but
well.
But it's a debt. It's like a liability for
well,
them.
Well, we give them...
We're not donating it.
Well, we can donate some of it, but then the rest is no interest.
Yeah.
Loan, which they don't have to pay back, really. All they have to do is buy our product. And they need our product because we make sure that they think they need our product.
Yeah, no, that's a very intriguing way of persuasion.
So where does the money come from? In the first place.
Yeah. That's what everybody wonders who was interested in this topic. You know, how can they actually afford to pay for all these expensive army things? You know?
Well, they must have some sort of export. I mean, we couldn't really sell much to Greece because their export is flat. There isn't so maybe there is some sort of export potential in these poor countries who we want to buy our arms.
And they have some asset to offer, or what's the security asked for? Any? Willingness to sign the contract itself is enough.
Oh, that's enough to start the ball rolling, but it doesn't actually produce
the
income that can service the loans.
Yeah, that's what I wonder.
Have to pay
something
it back
has to be taken, yeah.
It's always rather difficult to come up with the idea of maybe other countries loan them money and they use that money and actually supply them with money, because what they might be is in a strategic geological situation for airports.
Right, so strategic advantage
or
economic asset, like resources?
There's always an economic asset there somewhere.
Yeah.
If they have the money, then somehow or other that money comes from an asset that they have.
Yeah.
And it might only be an asset to us. They can't use it, but we can.
Mm-hmm.
So that asset, I think, would be enough to service the loan.
Where would this all end up? I mean, if this continues, we have countless conflicts at the moment. I can't even count them all. So many there are presently raging, and threats of conflict, not actually enacted yet, but the threat which is the optimum climate for this kind of business, isn't it?
Wonderful, yes.
And where will we end up with ever-growing, increasing zones of distress, the same, just sort of neutrally?
That's just an effect. It can't be helped.
Mm.
We do have to trade. We do have to make a profit. Everybody must do that to some extent. So all those things that you've just mentioned, the distress and everything else, is a side effect. The poverty. They spend all their money on buying our arms. Wonderful.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah, that's good for us.
Do they also buy prostheses, and the mines come with prostheses, as you indicated?
If we can sell them that as well, we have the United Nations, the UN.
So they do cost an arm and a leg, as you've written recently.
Well, they do cost an arm and a leg, or even more.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can cost... the whole deal, you're alive.
Well, it's remarkable. I read in the papers now we have exported people from Australia building jihad schools somewhere else, you know, or training people or inviting people to get trained for
Isn't
jihad.
Isn't that interesting? Yes,
we that's sort of the other side of the coin.
Very necessary. I didn't hear any music. Where's the music?
Well, the music is in the background, and I tolerate it. I'm not against it. Okay.
Later, I can't.
Let's sort it out later, and pay the musician first.
Oh, well, all right. We'll pay the musician.
That you get all these other side effects inadvertently, perhaps, but they do appear. That people from lower demographic status walk over to the Middle East and start schools, you know, like Australians, and they get used here for being trumped up to be terrorists or something like that, making it newsworthy.
Well, everybody wins. Everybody profits out of that sort of thing.
Mm.
And, think of the media. The media's got to make a profit.
Yeah, they got a name and a photo of a guy, that's already reason enough. Yeah.
People want to read about that, and they have to pay for it.
Yeah.
So, it's good for everybody. And, of course, in this sense, he, as a terrorist, he's helping to sell our arms exports, our munitions.
This is an evasion of ministerial responsibility on a matter of public policy. Now, of course, we've discussed so much the conduct of ministers, we've somewhat forgotten that this whole story is part of a very unhappy record of British relations in the Middle East, which my honourable friend is going to raise again on Friday. Iraq was part of the world we took over when the Ottoman Empire disappeared. Britain bombed Iraq with chemical weapons in the 1920s, and a few months ago, the Queen Mother put up a statue to the man who did it. Bomber Harris was the squadron leader who used chemical weapons against Iraq. We planned to occupy Kuwait in 1958, and it all came out with the papers when Selwyn Lloyd wrote to Foster Dulles and said, we might take over Kuwait as a crown colony. And the double standards of British policy in the Middle East is the thing that will be noticed by anyone in the Arab world who reads this debate. We didn't take the view we did about Kuwait when Turkey invaded Cyprus, when the occupied territories were taken over by Israel. This Gulf War, looked at in the light of what we now know, was a war for profit, a war for oil, and a war for the control of the area. And now we are suddenly told that ministers who protested so vigorously about their defense of democracy and human rights were selling weapons to Saddam Hussein, who was repressing Kurds and Shiites before and after the war, and then saying it was just a question of flexible guidelines. 200,000 Iraqis were killed last year. by forces including our own. 150,000 Iraqi babies under five were expected to die by the Harvard medical team that looked at the bombing of the water supply by British, American and French bombers. And it is an act of odious hypocrisy then to come along, as honourable members have said, and say, but of course our industry needs the orders. People want the jobs. You remember the joke about the man producing nuclear weapons in America, and somebody said, how could you do it? And he said, well, a man's got to live, hasn't he? And that is the argument, that somehow you can justify the supply of weapons in that way. The international arms trade is a greater threat to world peace than the AIDS epidemic or the drugs trade, because it's supported by governments. It props up dictators, the Shah, Batista, Marcos, Papadoc, all these people, Pinochet, props them up, and they get the weapons to crush their own people in the interests of keeping down their own people, so that the multinationals can make a profit from the superpowers that sell them the weapons. And then, because they bought the weapons, they get into trouble with the IMF, and the IMF comes along and says, cut your social budgets, because you've got to pay the debt on the arms you bought to keep down your own people. And of course, the waste of skill. Some of the most brilliant scientists and engineers in the world are working on methods of death instead of the means of life. And billions and billions and billions of pounds are wasted on weapons that could have saved lives. And a heavy responsibility rests upon everybody, and I know every government to some extent has done it, who promotes the international arms trade. Because there have been 134 wars since 1945. Millions have died in them, using weapons that were supplied by the superpowers very often. And millions more died because they were denied the resources that were wasted in the arms program itself. Ministers will not tell the House the truth on this matter. Ministers use intelligence, and everybody knows it, we've had a reference to it, and are prepared to sacrifice intelligent people to conceal the truth. This is a matter the House should deal with by select committee. Look at Oliver North. They had him up before a congressional committee and they grilled him for weeks on it, on Watergate. When Peter Wright wrote a book saying he'd committed treason, they spent millions of pounds trying to prevent the book getting into the hands of the British people. Because the central question is, who is allowed to buy the weapons? Who controls it? Who knows what happens? Who tells the truth? And finally, does the House take the responsibility for holding government accountable? Or does it shuffle it off, like so much else, to a commission here, an agency there, yeah, or a High Court judge there? Because if it does that, we shall be burying this House as a historic defender of the rights of the people we represent, some of whom were sent to fight in Iraq against an army we had armed.
The central bank scam is really a hidden tax. The nation sells bonds to the central bank to pay for things it does not have the political will to raise taxes to pay for. The beauty of the plan is that not one person in a thousand can figure it out, because it's usually hidden behind complex-sounding economics gibberish.
A fiddler with the truth. Sounds crazy, no? But you could say that in our little city of Washington, D.C., every one of us is a fiddler with the truth, trying to take a position that makes everyone happy. Now you may ask, is it possible to answer a question without offending anyone? Well, yes and no. We know there are many, many poor people. So what would be so terrible if I just took a little bit more of some people's good fortune? Spread it around a little bit. If I tax each rich man, oh, Solyndra, I could lend you all the cash you'd ever want. All day long I'd piddle tidy sums if I tax each wealthy man. Oh, who cares if they work hard? Warren Buffett says to stuff it, they can tough it out, and then I would have so many, many fans if I tax salons where Boehner tans. I'd give free health insurance out by the millions, pay off the houses they foreclosed, electric cars without any tanks to fill. There would be new green fuels with jobs by the thousands if we paid, no one would be opposed. if we force Catholics to go on the pill. I'd start new programs where your cat could get food stamps. Class warfare lines would now be drawn. If the rich complain, I'll just raise their tax again. And as our stash goes up, I'd have extra money to pay for gay weddings from now on. But only if they play It's Raining Men. It's such a simple tax plan, 'cause the right that's great for you and you and you and you and you will be in the budget I submit. Here's how I will get votes out of it. Your tax rate will now apply to Mitt. And I bet you 10,000 middle-class voters that if that happened, I'd be a re-elected man. Huzzah! Thank you.
Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes the laws.
In the Great Hall of Injustice, there are assembled the world's greatest economic superheroes, created from the collapsing cosmic collateral of the universe. Fat Cat, when it comes to fighting crime, he has no restraint. No restraint. I mean it. The Deregulator. He doesn't follow the rules he makes. He makes the rules he doesn't follow.
This is the air traffic controller. You can't do that, sir. It's against the rules.
I'm the Deregulator. Damn it.
The Greenspan Lantern, a shining beacon of hypocrisy. You don't want to meet him in a dark alley. And Red Tape, bitten by a radioactive acorn volunteer, she fights corporate crime by making it incomprehensible.
Hey.
The Shadow Banker, more powerful than a liberal motive, able to leap logic in a single bound. Look, up in the air, your hopes. Your dreams, your... Oh, sorry. Thought I saw... Never mind. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of the Shadow Banker? Everybody? And with the help of other super frauds like... Embezzle Man! Warding off the depression with his golden parachute of privilege. And the media! With her supernatural powers of persuasive revision, saving the world from reality because we can't handle the truth. Captain Escrow, getting back to you in 30 to 60 days, under certain conditions. These are the super frauds, sworn to protect the privileged few. Their mission, total global financial control. The Super Fraud Injustice League, saving the world for themselves, one bank at a time. Get out of there!
We had a dinner party last week. The Fontaines came over, and Tiffany Trubley brought some wine she made from some old wine, and it was nothing fancy, just some, you know, hors d'oeuvres, downgraded caviar, and our cat. I found the caviar in the cutest dumpster in Brighton.
I looked like $100. I wore my best Vera Wang Chung, and I had just lost 3 pounds on that new poverty diet, so who does she think she is? Serving cat? Flaunting it like she was made of money?
The cat? It was great. Delicious. Tasted nothing like chicken.
Now the first meeting of a commission appointed by Congress to examine the events of last year's near collapse of the financial services industry.
Were you pulling funny business while you were doing business with everyone's money on the line?
Some of the activities we undertook contributed to prevailing mood of the time.
So did you know right then it would all come crashing in? That something funky was cooking.
We didn't know it then, or even today, when it actually crossed over into bubble territory.
So you did see it
coming? You didn't see it coming. Well, did you see it coming? Did anybody see it coming?
No one involved in the housing system foresaw dramatic and rapid depreciation in home prices.
No one.
Lenders.
Nobody.
Rating agencies.
Anybody.
Investors.
Somebody.
Insurers. Consumers. Regulators, policymakers.
So you didn't see it coming at all.
And then when you look back, you always look back and you look back. And you said, well, these were warning signs.
And then when you look back, you always look back and you look back. And you say, well, these were warning signs.
They're not obvious at the time. They're only obvious in hindsight. They're not obvious at the time. They're only obvious in hindsight.
So no one ever could have seen it coming at all.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure about that.
What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. I just want to assure you that I had absolutely nothing to do with the current financial crisis.
I don't know what I've been told. Shadow bankers have no soul. Buy out 1, 2, default 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. You're screwed!
Do you have what it takes to take what they have? They come from every corner of the country. Harvard, Yale, Stanford. They come in every shade of white, pale, peach, ecru. They trade in times of peace, wage in times of war. They are the checks, the balance. They set the standard by which we thrive. They are here for the venture of a lifetime, self-serving their country since 1913. They are the proud, the rich, the reserves.
My Lord, we've tried so hard. We've tried everything. Everything.
Then, in March 1976, Britain fell into the abyss.
2030! Change it!
Change! 2025!
Foreign investors, led by American bankers, panicked. The pound began to slide against the dollar, and nothing would stop it.
Sorry?
Just lost 2025 and stopped
it. 1025, stock it.
It dropped 100 points. We don't know why. It just dropped 100 points when everything else was staying steady.
Britain faced bankruptcy. In desperation, Labour turned to the International Monetary Fund for a loan. An IMF team came to London. They were determined that the only way to restore confidence was for the British government to adopt monetarist policies. In a speech that could have been written by Keith Joseph, Prime Minister James Callaghan told the Labour Party why it had to do what the financial markets wanted.
We used to think that you could spend your way out of a recession and increase employment by cutting taxes and boosting government spending. I tell you in all candor that that option no longer exists, and that insofar as it ever did exist, it only worked on each occasion since the war by injecting a bigger dose of inflation into the economy on every occasion, followed by a higher level of unemployment as the next step.
It was presented scientifically, but then they always present it scientifically as being the only way of doing it. There is no alternative. And this gripped people. But at the same time, you must never forget that politics is in the pursuit of an interest and an ideology. And if the scientist helps you with the ideology, you use him. If he doesn't, you disregard him. So the conflict between, as it were, Milton Friedman and Keynes was a political conflict. It wasn't really that it was people solemnly assessing the different values of two sets of ideas. One benefited one group, another benefited another.
The game is up for climate change believers. The game's up, says Charles Moore. It's up. It's a game. Believing in climate change was a game. It's a game where you believe that all this evidence that there's climate change, you know, stuff melting and that. That game, that's over and done with now. It's a different game now where we all die. It's called Who Can Have Enough Money to Survive in Armageddon? And I have one of the people that's got enough money. Behind all the layers of stupid Charles Moore, there is a divine being who is beautiful, who knows that we have to live in harmony with our planet. And even though Charles Moore's whole life inculcation and education has taught him that he has to support the industries, energy companies, big industry that are destroying the planet, deep down, he knows that that isn't the right thing to do. I'm Charles Moore, And if it were up to me, I'd spend every day with these two fingers of mine up my smug little Botticello, only taking it out every half hour or so to run it across my top lip. That lets off a little bit of the frustration at the sense of that politicians are corrupt, whilst not addressing the fact that the political system itself is corrupt. What needs to change is this system that produces those kinds of results. In fact, it could be said that the last 30 years have seen the construction of a vast bureaucratic apparatus for the creation and maintenance of hopelessness, a giant machine designed first and foremost to destroy any sense of possible alternative futures. So, like, for all of these papers, it's sort of like we complain, don't we, that sort of junk food can make you lazy, Britain may be blocked from EU arrest warrants, like, oh no, that woman's fiddling her expenses. We complain about it, but the possibility of an alternative is never raised. To do so, to maintain this machine of hopelessness, to do so requires creating a vast apparatus of armies, prisons, police and propaganda engines of every conceivable variety, most of which do not attack alternatives directly, so much as create a pervasive climate of fear, jingoistic conformity and simple despair that renders any thought of changing the world idle fantasy. Maintaining this apparatus seems even more important to the exponents of the free market, even than maintaining any sort of viable economy. So more important than making sure that the sort of economic and political system that we have functions well is the constant insidious derision of any possible alternative. Because if people don't think that there's any alternative, it doesn't matter how unhappy we are with what is happening now, because there's no option. Dum, 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 dum. That was some truth today. That was your truth. That was your truth today. I want some more truth. There's no more truth. There's no more truth. Dum.
She said, well, you can buy a council house, so you'll be a property owner. You may not be able to get a wage increase, but you can borrow. And the borrowing was deliberately encouraged because people in debt are slaves to their employers. That's how the whole thing began. And that's why borrowing was a deliberate policy to make the working class today slaves again. And that's exactly what they are. I mean, many trade unions don't go on strike because they're afraid they lose their job and lose their home. And so that's what the policy was. She also attacked local government, which was the beginning of further education and school education, schools and all that, and she destroyed local government. So local councils now are just agents of the Treasury. They can only spend money the Treasury give them on things the Treasury tells them they can spend it on. They're sub-agents of a sort of right-wing bank. And she attacked the public sector and privatised it. And this privatisation is internationally. I met an old friend of mine called Kenneth Kaunda, who's the president of Zambia. I met him when he came out of a British prison years ago, before he was president. And he said, we had a great debt, and the IMF came along, and he said, I'll lift your debt if you'll sell off all your schools and hospitals to multinational corporations. So privatisation is a deliberate policy, along with the destruction of local democracy and the destruction of the trade union, to restore power back to where it was. And what we are now back in, that's what the whole crisis is about, the restoration of power of those who've always controlled the world, the people who've owned the land and the resources and all the rest of it. And that is something we need to understand. And just get it. When I hear the government say we want to restore confidence in the banking system, well, I must say I don't want to restore such confidence in the banking system. They do it all over again. Because this theory that wealth trickles down, actually wealth bubbles up to the people at the very top. And so what we have to do is to have a long-term plan in our mind. Mind you, the short-term battle is going to be a big one. But the longer term, all the banks should be publicly owned. And if you put money into the banks, the first thing you say to them is no more bonuses this Christmas. That would just be a start. And then see that the money is directed to help people who need to raise money for businesses or do whatever is necessary. Then all the public services, gas, electricity, water, transport should be publicly owned. Of course they should be. And actually, that's not a difficult argument to put across. We're not alone if we say that. Tory former Thatcherite minister said to me, a time we'd go on a television programme, it was a catastrophe to privatise the railways. Well, if they think it, Labour might have thought the same too. And I think these arguments, I say this to build confidence at the end, don't think we're an isolated little group. I go around the country doing meetings all the time. I'm engaged in a permanent by-election when I'm not the candidate and there's no polling day. And what really pleases me is the way the arguments you've been put tonight put into any audience, and you'd be surprised how much support there is. They don't want the war, they don't want privatisation, they don't want pensions and means tests, they don't want students settled with debt, they don't want civil liberties taken away, they do want Labour properly able to play its role, so we're not alone. I think progress has been made by two flames that have always been burning in the human heart. The flame of anger against injustice and the flame of hope you can build a better world.
Details of this show and other shows of the Kaput X Radio series can be found at radioforall.net. Also available on the program page is a contact box for your convenience. Kaput Radio, devoted to small people.
How tired are you?
Even Google listens to Kaput Radio.